I'm Bill Barol. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
Earlier this year, we came together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 6, Elephants in Rooms. Dear Bill, the last gig I had before the pandemic went from an intriguing side character to the antagonist of the world's year was in a hotel near Heathrow Airport. I was the cabaret for a convention of international private school heads from all over the world. There I was, on the stage of a ballroom, looking out at a sea of tables, each one from a different country. It was before most of us really completely understood how contagious COVID-19 is, but even then, it did seem like a dumb move. Always unable to resist the temptation to address elephants in rooms, I made a joke about how honoured I was to be the last piece of entertainment they'd ever see. It got the uncomfortable laugh it deserved. We've been mentioning the pandemic in passing throughout this season, so maybe it's time to get it out of the way, since at the time of recording this, it is the lead that's impossible to bury. So let's talk about what it's like to be creative when things are bad. Over the next week after that gig, the world changed. My entire year of work got cancelled. Shows in America, Australia, Canada, Europe, a UK tour, a premiere of a brand new theatre show at the Edinburgh Festival, private shows all over the world, all gone in a matter of days. There's a moment in the brilliant Joan Rivers documentary, A Piece of Work, where Joan stares down the lens and she says, "You want to see fear?" And she holds open a diary with blank pages. That's fear. Well, multiply that by not knowing when things might get back to normal, if they ever do, plus venues going under, plus little government support. And that's just the work stuff. We're not even talking about the actual emergency, the actual important stuff, the stuff outside of my privileged show business whinging, the deaths, the poverty, the completely understandable and correct climate of panic and fear and depression. Thing is, usually when real life is or feels awful, I have a secret weapon. In the past, over the years, there have been many times when the outside world has felt harsh and cruel. When friends have died, when my depression has been kicking my ass, when things have, in whatever way, felt dark. And in those times, more often than not, I've had the relief of a show to do. 20 minutes or an hour on stage, in my warm, safe bubble where the rules are simple and I know what I'm doing, and the outside world can wait. But this time around, that respite was out of reach for the foreseeable. So I did what I'd learned from busking. If your usual pitch isn't available, find another one. I arrived at YouTube with a cursory knowledge of how to make videos, and I started making videos. Not because I needed the approval of an audience, or because I thought I could make money out of it. And seriously, if you're looking for either of these two things on YouTube, you're gonna be disappointed. But because, after a whole-ass adult life of being a professional creative, if I'm suddenly not doing it, then it kind of begs the question, what exactly am I for? Being creative in hard times is perhaps counterintuitive. It might feel tricky to get into that groove. Perhaps you'll feel selfish. People are dying, and here I am writing a song or sculpting, or even worse, on YouTube? But when the world, or even just your world, feels like it's out of your control and spinning in a way that's making you feel sick, well, then I figure it might be useful to focus on something that could be seen as unimportant, meaningless, but something that you are in charge of. Something where your choices determine what happens. Something that other people who are in as much pain as you might need, to take their minds off things for a while. So, Bill, it's the last episode of season one. You want to join me in kicking that elephant out of the room? I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Yes. Here we are at the end of what we've been semi-grandly referring to in our Slack channel as season one of the show. And I think you've correctly identified it as the right moment to peel back the curtain and talk about our own process and about the hulking coronavirus-shaped elephant in the room. But first, do you banish an elephant from a room? I mean, is that what you do with it? I always thought the operative metaphor was you acknowledge the elephant in the room, because getting it out of the room is too big a task on account of it being a huge freaking elephant. Anyway, by all means, let's talk, explicitly at last, about the pandemic and about how and why to be creative in hard times. We have, as you say, glanced off the topic of the virus in passing. That's been a calculated decision. In our back-channel conversations about the show, we've both felt it was unreasonable to pretend the pandemic didn't exist, that our back and forth on creativity was somehow taking place in a COVID-free world. I think that was the right call for two reasons. We would have been glib and dishonest if we did that, because the thing is too real and all too big to pretend that it wasn't informing our thinking and our writing. And I think we both had a sense of the trajectory the pandemic was likely to follow. That it wouldn't, as much as we hoped otherwise, blip off the screen before we could get the show out there. I'm sorry to say we were right about that. It's mid-April as I write this, and I'm less than a week away from getting my second Moderna shot. And here in the States, our cities are starting to emerge, blinking, into a spring that, if it isn't post-pandemic, is maybe early pre-post. But because we never get to have nice things, health authorities are watching uneasily as the rate of vaccine uptake is flattening. And elsewhere in the world, the situation continues to be grim. India is on fire. Brazil, Turkey, Argentina, all surging. In the UK, researchers are warily keeping an eye on what may be coming in a few weeks, when you'll be a little bit past the recent broad reopening of restaurants and pubs. I hope with everything that's in me, you guys aren't headed for another wave. But I don't think there's a chance in hell that by the time listeners hear me saying this, our talk about the pandemic will sound dated. I also made a stupid joke at the beginning of lockdown, because great minds apparently think alike, especially when they're blithely unaware that they're about to get poleaxed by history. On March 2nd, 2020, 4 days before you got up to perform in that hotel ballroom, I posted to Twitter, "Social isolation? Count me in, baby!" It was funny, see, because I'm an introvert, and yeah. Yours was better, I think. It was wittier, and doomsday humor is, in my opinion, just a higher grade gas than the sort of winsome self-referentiality I was going for. But we were both doing what we do, right? I was figuring out my evolving stance toward the world by writing about it, and you were presenting yourself to an audience, trying to feel them out maybe, or at least put them at their ease. Those may have been, for each of us, the last moments in which our normal creative reflexes and the drift of the world were in sync. We weren't unusual in this regard. Everyone we know could, I suspect, put their finger on a moment when the everyday world they knew slipped from their grasp, even if they didn't know it at the time, because you rarely do. It was a little bit heart-stopping to hear you recite the itinerary you would have traveled in the year following that gig. Because every one of those canceled bookings doesn't just represent the fun of travel, the joy of performing, the alchemy you've discussed by which a random crowd of strangers becomes your audience. They also represent payments toward your electric bill, your phone bill, your mortgage. Performers have been among the workers who felt the biggest hits to their pocketbooks in this thing, and governments have been slow to stanch the ripple effect that spread to people who work in all those theaters and bars and cabarets. So I want to say it again, as I did when we started. I admire the drive that's kept you creating, whether or not it's paid your bills, which it hasn't. You asked rhetorically if it was a counterintuitive thing to do, or somehow a frivolous one in a time when people are enduring a global trauma. I don't think it is. I think it's an affirmation of something we talked about back at the beginning of this season. We create because it's the way we make sense of the world. I liked something you said about being on stage. You called it a place where the rules are simple and you know what you're doing. Which is, of course, the opposite of the world we've all been living in since last March. So why create in a time when the rules are obscure and nobody knows what they're doing? Because it's what we do. In a time when the world as we know it is gone, creativity is a way of capturing the world as we find it, holding it up to the light, and seeing what sparks back at us. It's a survival strategy for our spirit. So keep making those videos, which are fantastic, by the way, until the day you can get up on stage again and punch back in for what you call your stupid job, which, for the record, I don't think is stupid at all. Now, trying to get an elephant out of a room? That'd be stupid. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill. Okay, look, we can all get overly specific about the technical ins and outs of elephants and rooms, but must I remind you that you first saw me in Hollywood's world-famous Magic Castle, in a room where, for all any of us know, there might well have been, hiding behind a mirrored panel or some such, an elephant. Or at least a white tiger, or some rabbits or something. You're right, though. Elephants in rooms are for addressing, but really, what does that achieve? We can all address the elephant in the room, but then we're all just standing there staring at an elephant. Surely, the next step, if we can, is to figure out what the hell we do about it. I think the pandemic isn't just something that we're duty-bound to talk about on this podcast, although it is. It's one of those rare events so wide-ranging that it affects and influences everyone on every level, from physical, emotional, intellectual, financial, even spiritual, but also because I wonder if we'd be doing this at all if it wasn't for COVID. It's worth mentioning, perhaps, that we have never actually met face-to-face. Would we have started collaborating across the Atlantic on Slack and Zoom if we hadn't had more local face-to-face communications restricted? You're right, of course, about our respective bad jokes being about putting people at ease. Me telling a room full of international delegates basically that they were all going to die served two purposes. Firstly, well, yeah, elephants in rooms again. I can't entertain to the best of my ability if I suspect half the audience is distracted by something else. That's why you have to shut down hecklers. It's just that in this case, undeniably, in the back of everyone's minds and in the front of a lot of them, was the fear that something big and bad might be in the early stages of happening. So, by making a joke about it, and I made that joke pretty early on in my set, I'm letting them know that it's in the back of my mind too. But for the next 20 minutes, we're allowed to shrug at it, share the moment together, clap at my dumb tricks. You can all go back to being terrified after I'm done over dessert. And that idea leads us to the second purpose. Putting people at ease is pretty much exactly our job definition, right? Making them relaxed, happy, helping them to be only in the moment. The entire point of entertainment is to allow you to forget every other element of your life. A good piece of art can do what mindfulness practitioners take years to teach, focus you on the now. If you're engrossed in, for the sake of argument, my act, well, then that safe bubble I talked about last time, where the rules are simple and I know what I'm doing, you're in there with me. We're sharing it. The real world and all its ghastly stresses will still be waiting for you later, but maybe I can distract you for now. I can't do much to affect what we're going through, but maybe I can do that. It's my birthday next week, and yesterday I had my second Pfizer vaccination. It was delivered by two fantastic giggling nurses who kept calling me Martin, despite that very much not being my name. When I mentioned that this did not inspire confidence in the whole putting a needle in me thing, they laughed. One of them waved the syringe in my face and said, "This I can do." Then they called me Martin again, stuck it in my arm, and we all took another minuscule step towards normality. For my birthday treat, me and my wife are going to spend a day drifting around central London, stopping at my favourite cafes, parks and shops. This has always been one of my favourite things to do, but having been not allowed to do it for more than a year, it feels especially special this time around. I'll start the day sat outside my beloved Bar Italia in Soho with a cappuccino and a slice of Nonna's cake, which is frankly about as good as it gets. Hopefully it won't be too long before I can buy you a slice too. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, the useful thing, the beautiful thing about metaphor is that it isn't literally true. I mean, this is the whole point of metaphor, right? to capture or illuminate something about truth that isn't itself true. It's a fool's errand. I tell you, a fool's errand to argue about a metaphor as if it were literally true. That said, so you have the room with the elephant in it, right? I mean, that's a given. And you and your friend or friends are in the room or nearby the room with a view into the room and the elephant within through some sort of observation window or closed circuit video feed, which I'd argue is preferable because I've been on safari and I know that the last thing you want is to be in a confined space with an elephant, particularly if it's a mature male. Just trust me on this. Anyway, you and your friend or friends have acknowledged the elephant in the room by consensus or some more formal means, a show of hands or a simple majority vote. And now, hold on, hang on. And now, what happens next is, according to you, it's time to, and I'm quoting, do something about it. Look, here's where the whole thing falls apart for me. What is it you plan to, quote, do? I mean, unless you're going to dart the thing and then demolish a wall, which requires wrecking equipment, permits, and insurance, and you have a qualified large animal vet standing by on the other side with a winch and a crane and a very large flatbed vehicle for transport to a nearby wild animal park with which you've already made custody arrangements. You see what I mean? All due respect, my friend. What you're saying is ludicrous. Except for that, I'm only going to quarrel with one thing you said, which was that putting people at ease is our job description. I think this is a place where our job descriptions diverge. We both work in creative businesses, it's true, but, and I'm wearing my reporter hat now, not my comedy writer hat, which is a cartoonishly oversized red velour Homburg with a foot-long peacock feather. When I'm functioning as a reporter, the operative value is, as the old cliche has it, to both comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And the truth is, the second of those has usually been held to be the more important, even in hard times. I have an old friend, also a reporter, who, when I once expressed some satisfaction at having written a Newsweek profile that I thought would bring some well-deserved publicity to a documentary filmmaker, grumpily told me that he didn't consider journalism one of the helping professions. Reporters like to see themselves this way, as avenging angels with keyboards. It's woven into the ethos of the trade. For an entertainer, though, whole different story. Putting people at ease isn't just a nice idea to strive for, especially in hard times. It's a practical necessity, because people who are strung out with anxiety or otherwise have split focus make for poor audiences. I confess it had never occurred to me that the reason you want to put down hecklers as fast and hard as you can is that they can introduce a show-killing current into the room. I mean, of course that's true, it's self-evident now that you say it, but it perhaps isn't something that a non-performer would know intuitively. So it makes all the sense in the world that your gallows humor with that ballroom audience was a way of diffusing that current and establishing control. It was a tool of your trade. The reasons for my weak little Twitter joke are, even for me, a little harder to analyze. I didn't think I was steering the conversation. Anybody who thinks they can steer the Twitter conversation is, plainly, nuts. I don't even think I was doing it to allay my own growing anxiety in that moment. As I said way back in episode 1, my recollection of the pandemic's early hours is that we genuinely had no sense of the size of what was coming. I'm not saying I haven't used social media to try to sage the room of my awareness. I'm just saying that on that particular day, this wasn't that. Sometimes creativity is simply about mining the material at hand. And when it comes to creativity on Twitter, which is a real but a rare creature, it's scattershot. How do we do it? David Letterman used to say when a joke went south. Volume, volume, volume. I'm now almost exactly 24 hours away from getting my second Moderna shot, which my wife and I will receive in the most LA possible way, a drive-through site at Dodger Stadium. I'm fully expecting to be knocked flat for the following 48 hours or so, but I'm going to take some comfort in the picture of you and your wife wandering London, a city we both love, taking those first few tentative steps toward whatever's coming next. Enjoy the cappuccino and an early happy birthday to you from here. And I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, look, the first question we have to address is how the hell did the elephant get in there in the first place? Because unless it snuck in through an air vent as a baby, however it got in, well, that's how it can get out. So I think there's a garage-sized door that someone's keeping quiet about. But if I'm wrong, then the solution is simple. Get a bunch of mice and throw handfuls of them through the window. If cartoons have taught me anything, then they've taught me that with enough mice running around, the elephant will freak out and knock that wall through all on its own. What happens to it once it's out of the room? I cannot stress this enough. I don't care. I'm just happy to be contributing to the urban legends that will start to circulate about the wild elephant that people sometimes catch a glimpse of in the small hours of the morning foraging for food in trash cans. You know, I'm not actually sure if it's possible to just catch a glimpse of an elephant. Anyway, it's funny. You talked about how my job is more about putting people at ease than yours, how I don't have the duty to inform, and that's certainly true. That sometimes makes me feel that what I do is a bit shallow and meaningless, but bearing in mind the amount of time and effort we've been spending debating competing strategies for dealing with fictitious elephants, maybe the bar is lower than I thought. Most of the time, though, I quite like the basic purity of what I do. Put smiles on faces, show people something they might not have seen before, send them out feeling a bit better than when they went in. I like the simplicity. But still, I'm one of those people who isn't going to hide what I think about things for the sake of broad appeal. This could be one of the reasons I don't have broad appeal. I feel very relaxed on stage, which can be dangerous. It means that I'm happy to just say what's on my mind, for better or worse. When Boris Johnson, that dollar store fascist made out of marshmallow and inbreeding, was somehow elected my Prime Minister, I happened to be performing at a month-long variety festival in Hanover, Germany. Lovely gig. When I'm working abroad, I tend to play up the snippy Englishman character a little bit. So I figured that since everyone knew about our election, it would be an odd thing for my onstage persona to not mention it. So I spent a couple of minutes of the show desperately asking the audience if any of them were renting out rooms because I really didn't want to go back home now. It's funny because it's kind of true. And there it is again. Just like with the pandemic, my desire, my need to be funny came from real fear. Shtick is a useful process with which to pass real-world things that might otherwise feel too heavy to contemplate. When I did my first live show after a long bout of lockdown, in a disinfected venue with a third of the usual size audience, all arranged in socially distant seating, I couldn't help myself. I just want to say what a privilege it is, after such a tough year, I said, to be able to stand on stage and look out at a real live audience and infect them. I was legit scared about doing that show for that exact reason. So, oh, hello, elephant. At least put a red nose on the end of its trunk, right? Creativity is a Swiss Army knife. Its main blade, the most important one, the one you buy it for, is just to create for the sake of it. You gotta keep that one sharp if you can. But it's got all these other little blades too. It's a defense mechanism. It's a crutch. It's an anesthetic. It's a distraction. It's a counterpunch. It's all I got. And sometimes, often, it's enough. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, there was a book that everyone I knew carried around in their hip pockets a couple of decades ago. Blue Highways, by a guy with a fantastic pen name of William Least Heat Moon. Birth name, by the way, William Trogdon, which is less fantastic. I don't know if it made the kind of splash over there that it did here. It was an account of the author's wanderings along the back roads of America in a 1975 Econoline van, a vehicle about which I know just one thing, which is that if you want to wander the back roads of America in one or any other roads, you better keep wandering, because an Econoline that's a quarter century old will likely announce its sudden retirement if you're ever so foolish as to cut the ignition. Anyway, the van may have been unsound, but the thesis wasn't. Your trip is going to be more interesting if you're open to wandering. I feel like we've wandered some of the back roads this season, the ones where digressions on pro wrestling and hats and basketball are visible through the windshield and make at least a kind of sense. Now, there is an interstate highway version of this trip we've been on, and that version, the speedy and efficient one, would have delivered us to our conclusions in a more direct fashion. But the trip wouldn't have been as much fun. So I want to thank you for that. Creativity is, or maybe I should say it ought to be, a wander, a jaunt. Because it's often in the digressions that the most valuable insights lie. That's as true in hard times as any other kind of times. But there's no question that hard times complicate the equation. As we begin what now seems likely to be a long crawl into a post-pandemic world none of us can quite picture yet, and I look back at how COVID life started, I'm struck again by how quickly we tumbled into a new way of living, a set of rhythms and routines that altered the little things so thoroughly that the big things sometimes took a back seat. I don't think I noticed in that period, as my drive to be creative slipped quietly from the room. There were a lot of other things going on in the room at the time, of course. Fear, uncertainty, a sense of mortality forcing its way in from the place outside where I'd managed, where most people manage, to keep it safely at bay. So I guess it wasn't just one elephant in that room after all. It was a whole herd. It was a lot. I think that's why I was so taken with your drive to keep creating in lockdown, in any form you could, even one in which you didn't have the kind of mastery to call on that you do in performing. That was a brave move. Look, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it was rushing into a burning building brave. But it took some guts. It took a willingness to show people something other than the thing you can, after years of effort and practice, do best. And I admired that. Because while it's possible to create for ourselves alone, in isolation, and I find it all too easy to do that, especially when I'm not confident in my own abilities, while it's possible to do that, it cuts you off from the flow of ideas and inspiration that creative work can spawn, and the connection to others that means so much in a world where things aren't going to plan. Creativity will, like a fluid or a gas, find a way to make itself known if you let it. And if you do, it can be a lifeline. When we say we create because it's what we do, as we've said in this podcast, this is what we're talking about. It's our way. It's the best way to make sense of a world in which even the little things are scrambled. For you, it was YouTube videos. And for me, it was this. This podcast. This podcast gave me a thing to do. It gave me a frame in which to put my thoughts about who we are and what we do and why, and the processes by which we do it. It reminded me about discipline and serendipity and the unexpected conclusions that can be reached when two brains circle a big idea. It brought my working spirit back to life. So, thanks for that too. It's a Thursday, as I write this, and by coincidence, it's the day the CDC announced that fully vaxxed people can go without masks in most places. It's a good day. Spring is here, summer is coming. No time to cut the ignition. So let's not get off the back roads just yet. I'll see you soon for season two. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.